and stuff.
Blog, I was just going to say, if you want to talk about Turkey at the end.
Okay.
You, that's fine. I have a couple things to say.
Good evening and welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. I'm Karen Tate, and I hope you enjoyed part of that lovely song that we just opened with tonight. It's called Song of the Siren by Morgan Baum. And I want to apologize ahead of time for my voice tonight. I have been fighting a head and chest thing, and I know I probably don't sound like my normal self, but it is me. And also, too, with the holidays upon us, I especially want to thank you for tuning in during what I'm sure for many of you is a busy time, whether you're catching us tonight live or you're going to catch us later from the archives. Maybe you'll even listen while you're cooking turkey dinner. And please be sure to remember the three F's. Yeah, the three F's. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Be sure to become our friend and click on follow so that you never miss notice of any of my great guests each week. That way you also become part of our growing family of listeners around the globe. And you can do all of that from my they call it your show page on Blog Talk, where it lists what guest is coming up, what the show is about, where you listen. So the three F's: favorite, friend, and follow. Well, tonight we have a wonderful double feature for you, I think. Our guest at the top of the hour is Elizabeth Fisher, and our topic for tonight, we're kind of calling it Soul Travel with Global Goddesses. She's the author of two experiential programs. Gender Justice is one, and the one we're going to be more focused on tonight is Rise Up and Call Her Name. Now, the Rise Up curriculum, I'm announcing for the first time here, I believe, I'll actually be teaching beginning March in Orange County, California, at the Goddess Temple. So I've been anticipating this interview with Liz. Our talk tonight will reflect some of the elements of the Rise Up program, which is still so very important and relevant today. Liz will share a fresh perspective on the dichotomy between light and dark, the power in creating sacred bundles of experiences, and discovery of 11 tools for traveling, from chanting to mask making. And she'll explain what all of that means. And in her Gender Justice program, she explores the common sense idea that women's rights are human rights. Hey, who'd have thought, right? and discuss how the global effort for women's equality relies on the values of authenticity, compassion, full participation, fairness, and respect for Earth, all key elements that honor the sacred feminine. I hope we can fit this all in. And then we'll cross the threshold into the second part of the show with Jeanette Clancy, who is the author of God Is Not Three Gods in the Sky. I know a lot of you, probably like myself, might consider themselves recovering Catholics, or maybe just eclectic in terms of your spirituality, even progressive thinking Christians maybe. So I believe you'll enjoy this candid conversation where we're going to get into Jesus, the myth and the man, how nuns are among the coolest people on earth, and ideas about Christianity that Jeanette rejects. And I wonder if these ideas may have drove you from the church or helped make it less relevant. We'll see. We're going to talk about that stuff. Just be real candid and upfront. But before we start our interview, just a short bit of housekeeping. First, I want to invite you to read my new Examiner column and leave your comment. Of course, as you might imagine, it's about Thanksgiving, and the title is Thanksgiving, a Holiday Fantasy Written by the Conquerors. You know, my husband tells me sometimes I think too much. I'm constantly questioning. I want to know the secrets. I want to know what's behind that locked door. I want to sweep away the cobwebs that distort truth and see what's been swept beneath the rug. So you can imagine what a charged holiday Thanksgiving is for me, I bet. No, it's not about standing in line at 3 a.m. to buy more stuff on Black Friday. It's not about getting together with family either, I'm afraid. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Home for the Holidays with Holly Hunter. Well, I can relate to her character, and if you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. And, you know, I guess I'm no domestic goddess either. I'm not a fan of cooking and baking, so I've had to make my own traditions for Thanksgiving, and one of those includes honoring the unofficial history of the conquered, as well, of course, remembering to give thanks and gratitude, especially for the ones we love. So anyway, with that said, I've rerun my annual Thanksgiving column portraying what I've come to know as a more accurate picture of Thanksgiving than children are taught in school. And with the Texas Board of Education currently on a conservative mission to rewrite the history books, I can only imagine what will be inserted and deleted in the years to come. So the article is really one written by a descendant of the conquered. So anyway, go there and read it if you like. You can just go to examiner.com Los Angeles, and in the search you can put in my name. You'll either get columns about me or by me pop up, and if that seems like too much of a circuitous route, just go to my website, KarenTate.com, and on the top of the first page, there should be a link there to my column. And I started mentioning last week that on my website now, too, is the itinerary for the sacred tour I'll be leading to Turkey next November. I also have someone editing a tape of some rituals we did during our last tour to Turkey, which I know you'll enjoy seeing, even if you might not make it with us on this third time round to visit Anatolia, Land of the Nourishing Mothers. But it will be on my website soon. And next November is the time we're going, and I'm taking both men and women on the trip. We'll be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Chatal Hayuk, Side, Lagina, and Lagina, I'm not sure exactly which way that's pronounced. That's where you find Hecate's only standing temple that we have found to date. So it may be the only one left. We'll be doing activities like dream incubations, rituals at the site, and a lot of these sites are not overrun by tourists. So coupled with the time of the year that we go, last time we went, we had the ritual sites all to ourselves. Turkish baths will be something we'll do. We'll do mineral baths near the domain of Aphrodite, outside Aphrodisias, and lots of other stuff. So if you're sort of feeling that pang or hearing the call for a sacred journey, whether it's to satisfy your body, mind, or soul, again, go to my website, KarenTate.com. Three people signed up last week, and we're only taking 20, and it's a year out. So don't hesitate. If you really want to go, you want to secure your place on the tour. There's been, you know, really good response early, and I don't have any doubt it'll fill. And while you're there, take advantage of the free meditations that are on the Goddess Store page. And I invite you, especially with our new influx of listeners from across town and across the globe, please check out my two books, which have garnered prestigious endorsements and awards. Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, is the first one, and the second is Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. They're both sold everywhere. The first is even sold in museum bookstores, and the latter was a finalist in the spirituality category of the National Best Book Awards in 2008. I guess they're great bookends. One is an encyclopedic account of goddesses around the world. The other is sort of a spiritual, socio-political look at embracing goddess, deity, archetype, and ideal, whether it be into your personal life or into your community. And finally, if you're listening live and want to call in to talk to either of my fabulous guests, the number is 718-766-4662. I know a lot of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see you on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a lapse in the conversation and invite you to give your comment or question, and I'll identify you by your area code. So let's not delay any further because we have a lot to get to and see a tiny bit more about Liz Fisher. She is a passionate advocate of multidimensional sacred culture, the author of the experiential course, Rise Up and Call Her Name, A Woman Honoring Journey into Global Earth-Based Spiritualities, which is a tapestry of creative activities that involves participants in a healing shamanic journey. This 13-session curriculum draws on many sources which honor the divine feminine in stories originating in the Mediterranean, Africa, Asia, and the Americas. A variety of artistic forms are featured that bridge information with emotional and spiritual experiences. Liz has been a longtime leader in the women and religious movement, participating over many years in numerous forums and workshops focused on feminist theology and women's issues. She convenes Rise Up classes, speaks about earth-honoring spirituality, and facilitates shared leadership seminars. She attended the 1995 UN Fourth World Conference on Women held in China, giving numerous presentations upon returning. She also co-authored a study course about the international women's movement entitled Gender Justice, Women's Rights, or Human Rights. And on a more corporate level, she's been in that world too. She's been a professional acquisitions editor for two major publishing houses. She's been employed as a psychiatric social worker in law and in law-related positions. She's got a degree in psychology from the University of Michigan and a certificate of in publishing from the University of California, Berkeley. Phew, Liz, you've been busy. I'm exhausted just reading your bio. Well, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being on.
Good to be here.
Well, thank you. And again, I apologize for my voice. How did the Rise Up and Call Her Name curriculum, and this is affiliated with the UU Church, correct?
Well, it was actually published by the Unitarian Universalist Women's Federation, which
okay.
is an affiliate of the UU Association, and but it's a separate group that really focuses on issues that relate to women and women's situation in the world.
Okay. Well, how did it come to be?
It's an interesting story because in the Unitarian Universalist Association there was quite an active women's it was called a women's movement, which was both about what our political role was and how we were treated in the world, and also what grew up was a real interest in spirituality and how women were pictured in the dominant culture religions and mostly in monotheism. And as that developed in the 70s and early 80s, of course, the pagan movement and feminist spirituality and women honoring different groups in the culture were also developing. So within the Unitarian Universalist world, this movement called upon the established institutions, which the Women's Federation was one, to really provide some kind of vehicle that could be used to explore spirituality from a different perspective. And if you remember during that period or people who were around, this was a really innovative and new thing to be doing, especially within an established institution, religious institution. So we were quite active putting forth the idea that we wanted to do this sort of exploration. We also wanted to do exploration that was multicultural and really honor women from different perspectives and honor really something that would hold up the female, whatever that was, or the female divine, and really explore that concept. So it was a grassroots interest, and it was an institutional response, I would say. And I got involved because I had originally met Shirley Rank, who you had on your show some months ago, who was the author of Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, and started to talk about the things that were able to be included in that course and which things were not. And one of the areas was really this multicultural exploration. So this course then came out of that interest, and I took on the responsibility for putting the course together. And that took about 5 years at the end of the 80s and the early 90s. And during that time, we worked with a lot of different people to pull together a rich body of material.
Well, it certainly is. I've just started to look at it because those classes are going to be coming up in March, and
right.
I'm never one to leave things to the last minute. And,
oh, well, you're lucky.
and it's certainly an incredible body of work there, and I'm really looking forward to it. Well, what's really interesting is it is very different from the cakes, and I think the two together make wonderful bookends because one is great for Western women sort of reclaiming their body and understanding that God was once, wasn't always a male, and, getting their power back and how Judeo-Christianity has affected them. But then Rise Up, well, that's more multicultural, and it's also more ritual-based, I think, too. The other has PowerPoint presentations. This one is more, you're going to tell me, but I think it's more involved with arts and crafts and ritual, a little bit more hands-on, would you say?
I think there's a lot of hands-on activities. In the original cakes that was put together, there were some activities, but they were much more confined, I think, and simple. And what we did in Rise Up was to bring forward different art forms that
mm-hmm.
are very integral to earth-based spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Art forms are part of the practice. So it called upon us to experience those. And what's interesting in Rise Up is that people actually get a chance to do various different activities. And they don't have to be experts or artistically inclined. Some of the people that have never done any art activities get the most fun out of that aspect of the course.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing those activities and then sharing them in a variety of ways, they act as bridges both to the cultures but also to other members of the group.
Well,
so they have a community building activity as well as just an artistic activity that you would be doing separately.
Right. Well, and I can see where, if you just relax into it, it could be quite liberating and a lot of fun, to maybe do things that you don't do every day.
Right.
Now, well, and you've actually referred to this Rise Up as shamanic, and you
yes.
call it a journey.
Right.
So so tell me how you're using those words and how it relates to the curriculum.
Well, I think shamanic for me is really encompasses healing. The idea of healing taking place of some sort. And so one of the aspects of this journey is to go into various aspects of sacred knowledge. And by doing that and actually experiencing it yourself, many people get these kinds of understandings that they would not have gotten if they hadn't taken this, what we call a journey. And the reason we're calling it a journey is because it goes through various places in the world. And from stories that are taken from those locations and reflected upon, you learn some truth, which you'll find echoed in another culture, which may be halfway around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a journey, but it's also an internal experience of touching into areas of yourself that you may not have experienced in this way before, and then connecting them to cultures you may not have much acquaintance with.
So we're talking about an inner journey and sort of a literal journey to other cultures around the world.
Well, I think so, because when we there's a video that's included with the course, and it's broken up into 11 different segments, which are shown in 11 of the 13 sessions. And those segments take images from an area of the world. So there are a couple of segments on Asia, and so you'll see actual sacred statues and hear what they mean, and also some contemporary art and some interpretation during the session. So during that particular evening when you're exploring Asia, you'll be able to see these images that are both ancient, because I did actually get many of these images from various museums that so they're the actual image from, say, the 1500s up to some contemporary interpretations, and wove those into some thoughts about those cultures. So each time you come, you'll have that different experience. So by the time you've gone through the whole course, you'll have had some African experience, some Asian, and some Native American, some Central American. And there are a couple of sessions at the beginning that cover Lilith and Hecate to have a bridge to the Mediterranean. So by going through that journey, you are having this acquaintance with the various parts of the world.
And you've called it experiential. So by that you mean the meditations, the art, the just all the activities that you've built into the program, or is there more
right,
to it?
Right. I think that's what it means because, for instance, storytelling. You learn that storytelling, how important that is in a culture. But then one of the exercises is that we get into groups of three, and each of the people in this group has one story from Africa. And they take 10 minutes, and they're told how to kind of prepare for storytelling. And then they tell it to the other two people in their group. So each person has a chance to really participate in that activity, not just be a person that's receiving that from, say, a professional storyteller. So
right.
You have that chance to really make that shift. Or making a mask. One of the most popular parts of the course is that we make these masks by using simple Fimo dough and different natural objects that are brought or little things to decorate these masks. And they're shields, actually. They're not full face masks, but they're little shields. But in that, you get to express what you've experienced during this journey. And so that mask then takes on a real personality by the end of the class. And then each of those are birthed through an activity, through a ritual that is a birthing ritual. So people get to experience what they've done during that class and then how they brought it back into the world.
Mm, and then that mask is the repository for all of that, and I'm sure it becomes a place of honor in a lot of the students' homes when this is all over.
Yeah, I've been just really impressed. People will send me pictures, and the whole shift that Western people who many of these women do not do these type of activities much, but they got involved in this, and they just have this experience of being connected in another way with the world. And we teach a little bit about what the mask means in indigenous cultures, because masks are very important, they're very sacred, they embody a certain kind of energy, and they're used in shamanic activities. And one of the things we are very careful in this curriculum to do is to understand that these are creative rituals that we've put together. We're not actually appropriating any kind of ritual from a living tradition. What we're doing is honoring what their processes are and then creating for ourselves something that would speak to us around those same elements. And that's been a very important part of this class. And the part on masks I actually developed with a Native American artist. She was a mask maker and a sacred pipe woman. She's featured in the video, and her teachings are in the course. And she, because of the nature and the respect that we were showing and the reasons why we were doing this type of course, she was very happy to participate in the development of it. So we had that kind of involvement, and that's why it does have that kind of respectful and authentic feeling because these people did participate.
Well, and you've already mentioned the hundreds of images. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. There's also a lot of chanting and songs in the curriculum as well, as I understand.
Yeah. We did we wanted to do also was just have this opportunity for singing and chanting, and people like to do that. And some groups have people in them who can handle that and help people learn how to do that. Others don't. So what we did was we have a CD that has 19 songs and chants on it that are used in each of the sessions. Some of them are simple chants. Others are music that relates to the topic in the class and so forth, so that they are easy to use on a CD now and can then just be played or can actually be used to teach whatever chant or ritual there is. And the CD itself is professional singers, so that it's a very interesting tape to listen to as well as using as a teaching mechanism.
I would imagine.
Yeah, and we did get several permission to put several people, like we have one on there from Sweet Honey in the Rock, which is breaths, and that's their actual recording of it, and several others from Lisa Teal, and then some talented songwriters that have agreed to have their material used in this class. So it's a rich part of the experience as well. And some people have actually used this as a listening tape.
Yeah, and the more you talk about this, I really can't wait.
I think it'll be great for you with all your international experience and your interest in all of these things.
Well, I think, you know, it sounds like just a wonderful, rich immersion, you know, just in other cultures. And I think that's so important for women here in the West, especially here in the United States. We're so isolated by those two big oceans. And, you know, there's so few people, really, statistically, who even have a passport. So, it's sad, really. But this is, something to help that awareness grow.
Well, one of the things, too, is that I did develop this material by interacting with a lot of different people right here in the Bay Area where I live, because we have a pretty eclectic group of people here and a lot of people who have knowledge about these sorts of things. So we were able to utilize those contacts even in our community, and that's one of the things that the curriculum also encourages, is that we do have multiculturalism right within our own communities here often, and to try to seek out some kind of contact there where you might make some exchange or go to festivals and different activities where you can have some contact with how the culture is being represented currently.
Okay.
And I really did was able to get a lot of information and experience that way as well. So, you know, while traveling is important and gives you a real good perspective, sometimes doing it right here can also open your eyes quite a bit.
Sure. Well, and you use a phrase that sort of has me intrigued. I don't totally understand it yet. So explain, if you would, sacred bundles. What do you mean by sacred bundles?
Okay. Well, this is an interesting part of the class, because what we do is that from the very beginning of the class, people are asked to bring a piece of material that's important to them. So they bring a scarf or some material they've collected to do some art projects or whatever means something to them. And then during most of the classes, there's some activity that produces an outcome. So when they first come, they're asked to bring two or three objects that represent their cultural heritage. And during that first meeting, there's a round robin around the circle, and people get to tell everyone else what they've brought. So that goes in their sacred bundle. And then the next session, there's a visit to the Temple of Isis, and part of that is to do a drawing. After you've done a meditation, you do a simple drawing. So that goes into your bundle. And each of these sessions, some other activity produces something you can put in your bundle. So by the end, you have all of these things in this bundle, and that bundle and the mask then becomes the shield on the bundle, and that's used in the ritual, the final ritual. And this whole idea of sacred bundle is something that is used by a lot of Native Americans in their sacred practices, where they put together what their power objects are, and they keep those in that special bundle, and that gives them the kind of spiritual inspiration that they require during their different life experiences. So we've created that during the class, and then each person has that to take away with them. And
well,
it was something
makes perfect sense now.
Yeah, and that's what that is. And it also ties into some other concept that we use, which is the tools for traveling. And I mentioned a couple of those, which is the chanting and singing and the rituals. And there's also meditations and dialogues. We do try to have some time when people can dialogue about various topics that relate to whatever's going on in that class. And there's a number of other things, the visual images and the storytelling. There's a little bit of dancing, and there's some exploration of improvisation, which is also a lesson that we go through during the class, is how improvisation can really be part of a spiritual experience and is used in a lot of indigenous cultures. So all of these things fit together into a pattern, which is the shamanic journey that Rise Up really encompasses.
Well, and I read a descriptor, too, where you said you're redefining myths as sacred stories helps participants explore their inner landscape. Could you explain that?
Yeah, well, I think what happens a lot of times, especially in the groups that we've done in our various churches, fellowships, societies, is people do come to develop somewhat of their own spiritual ideas or their own ethics to live by. And so one of the ways that those can be developed is to take stories. Many of the indigenous cultures use stories. And so each of our sessions has a core story of a goddess or a female image of the divine that is explored in depth. And that story, rather than being called a myth, and myths in Western culture have often been associated with untruths and, you know, oh, that's a myth. But in pre-patriarchal traditions, stories are really important. That's how the ethics and the beliefs and the faith is really developed. So we have taken those, we've taken a body of stories that we consider to be women honoring, and we've moved those, we understand those as sacred stories. And so by doing, telling those stories, they tell you something about yourself as well. And so you can explore kind of what you feel about yourself, and through that process of the story, you also can sometimes have a different perspective when you come, you know, come through that process. And
well, let me ask you this. Now, because in cakes, one of the affirmations we learned, I'm remembering, my brain is actually firing here, is that we have to really redefine our myths, because, you know, the myth we have is we have the creator God and male leadership, which has ended up in this patriarchal culture and society we primarily all live in. So we have to, you know, shift that back to where it was in the beginning, where, you know, God was a female and there was women's leadership. Is this sort of like that, mm-hmm. or it's a little bit different?
Well, I think it falls under the same concept, in that myths or stories about religious imagery affect an entire culture, whether or not you believe in that or you practice a religion that believes in that. So when you say there's these patriarchal myths, say, for instance, the myth of Adam and Eve, that is almost universally known in this country, I would say. And what is that myth and what does it teach? So we want to have, and that has become a sacred myth, even though we have other stories which we think are more accurate about what the ethics should be. So when we say that the myth is important and it has to be a sacred story, of course the content is the most important thing. And we want to put out a set of sacred stories that has different imagery than what we have been subjected to in this culture from the patriarchal institutions. And I think that has been actually very successful over the last 40 years, because this whole curriculum grew out of a period back in the 60s, I don't think you would hear much at all about any of this, because when I was starting to do any research before I ever got involved in the Unitarian Universalist societies was to look into some of this goddess material in the early 70s, and there was very little that you could find. You could find some in the Jungian psychology books, but that was about the sources that were readily available. But by now we have all of this body of stories. And we know there were so many goddesses in so many cultures. One of the women that worked on this curriculum wrote an encyclopedia for Oxford University Press where she included 11,500 goddesses, and that was just what she had been able to put together for that particular publication. Now, if you think back to, say, the early 70s, no one would have even... that wouldn't have made any sense to anybody to even understand what that was.
Right.
So that's what I mean by bringing these sacred stories. And then when you go to cultures that are in existence today, these stories are in their cultures. We in the West hadn't heard these stories and hadn't heard accurate renditions of them. If we had seen any of them, they were often misinterpreted. So that's one of the things that I mean by making these myths sacred stories and really holding them up, the ones that we've chosen.
Okay.
Because of their content.
And, well, so what would you say some of the earth-honoring beliefs are that are explored in the Rise Up curriculum?
Well, we have kind of a set, actually, that that I can just give you a little feel for, and we've covered some of them, but I'll just give you a little idea. The first one would be the spiritual journey has both an inner and an outer nature. So again, that's tying, as we said, the inner landscape with how you might act in the world, and that's part of that whole journey. And that there's a healing power that's often available, and it's made available to us through the honoring of the female and the earth. And so it's a new way of understanding how, when we do understand what the female means in a sacred sense, we gather some of this healing energy. And the spiritual communications are multidimensional, and that the sacred and secular worlds are one. And this is a concept that we do look into in one of the sessions, because it actually grows directly out of some of the African-American beliefs that we explore as part of the curriculum. So making the sacred and secular one is something that is part of this earth-honoring belief, because you're always living in that sacred space.
Right.
And, you know, the idea that compassion is important quality to develop, that's actually something that we want to concentrate on, how we can do that. And direct experience is another one of the earth-honoring beliefs, that you have this direct experience of the sacred. And it's sometimes called intuition, and that this direct experience is really valuable. And the one or two others are the fruits of the harvest becomes the seeds of the future undertakings. That's one of the things we do in one of the rituals, is particularly take a sacred corn and see how that seed can lead to the next part of our lives.
Hmm.
So those
we're going to have
a
fun.
Yeah, that's a sampling. Each of the sessions, you know, we try to craft them so you have these different experiences, and it's a tapestry, as I mentioned.
Right. Now, what about men? I know when I was doing cakes, I thought to myself, you know, I'd have to tweak things a little bit, but I think this would really be valuable for men. Do you feel the same way about that?
Yes, absolutely. We this curriculum has been done with groups of women and men fairly frequently, and it's been a positive experience from the feedback that I've received. And in the curriculum materials, there is a whole section where I have three men that wrote particularly about why honoring the feminine divine and getting involved in this has meant so much to them. And one of the things that that I really felt strongly about was how that information should be made available to both women and men, because so many of the times men tell us that they don't have really access to these kinds of images. And in other cultures that I was drawing upon, the sacred feminine is honored by both women and men. Men often devote themselves to a goddess in various traditions, and it's not looked upon as a separate activity. It's looked upon as part of the cultural perspective, as if there are these female energies that are so important. So, yes, I think men can be involved in these groups and have really enjoyed doing that. I will say, you know, mostly it is a preponderance of women, and often the groups, it's a small number of men compared to the number of women, but it seems to work for the people involved.
Well, and, you know, and I also think it's important, I mean, this is just my opinion, but that women... That women actually share these classes with men, because one of my frustrations has been, you know, coming up in the goddess community is, you know, some women feel like this is primarily for women, and because they say, well, men just don't get it. But how will men ever get it unless we teach them? You know.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that my experience, every time that I've taught these classes, I've taught cakes and I've taught Rise Up several times, and I've had men in the classes, and maybe it changes the way some people would participate, but I found that people became very free in experiencing it, and they didn't seem to make that distinction. So, yes, and I also think it's important for us to learn to share differently in groups of women and men so that we don't make everything gender determined, and we're able to be in mixed groups and be ourselves as women.
Absolutely.
And you
Absolutely.
Know, and deal with the dynamic, and learn that there are men that are willing and able and happy to be in that setting.
And
you
worthy. Worthy.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up through all this movement where when I was early on getting involved in the women's movement, it was such an argument about whether men should be involved.
Mm-hmm.
And often groups were not allowing men to be involved, but I think we're moving to a point where we want to see a change in that relationship. And these classes and groups can be ideal places to help that, you know, come about.
Yeah, I totally agree, because believe me, that discussion is still going on, and
yeah.
I'm always a proponent for including the men. Because,
yeah,
you know, I you know so many wonderful men. I mean, they all aren't horrible.
Yes, I know.
You know, and they would benefit so much from this and be our allies, you know. Anyway, but that's
another
discussion.
And I think also, just one more comment on that, I think as we make that more open and accept each other as individuals, while we look at the we look at diversity and we look at uniqueness and we look at multiculturalism, all of these topics, and one of the things we want to do is give people maximum individuality, you know, their authentic self, that they can be who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And we also want to understand our roots, so we know that there may be cultural things that have been passed down to us. And in America, often we don't have that cultural connection that we to previous generations, and much of what was practiced previously could be much more earth-based than we realized, even in the especially in the European cultures. I'm finding out that there's a lot of earth-based practices that took place. And so knowing that you have those roots, and then you can reach over to other people from other parts of the world and have some commonality, is important. And I think that's the same thing between women and men, to find that we have commonality as well as uniqueness and difference, and kind of how that all plays out. Being in groups together and exploring this material can help that, you know, process.
Well, because, I mean, ultimately, I think the goal, you know, once we have people remember and reaffirm the sacred feminine, well, then, you know, maybe we can get to the point where the gender lines blur, you know, and,
yes.
And then we're not even talking gender after a while.
Yeah, I think that's a good goal for us to think about. But in the meantime, these classes, as you said, are ideal, as I said, and how you were agreeing, that they are places where these things can be, you know, examined and experienced together.
Now, I'm wondering, Liz, if this is all, you know, the timing of this is just so, seems like it might be so perfect, at least for me personally, because, you know, I'm leading that tour to Turkey in November,
yeah.
And I'll be teaching this through the summer. We can, and I know you've been to Turkey, and I want to talk about that next, but can you take some of the ideas from the curriculum and use them at the sacred sites?
Sure. You mean the sacred sites you're going to be visiting in Turkey?
Right, right. Do you think they
yeah.
enhance a spiritual, a real spiritual pilgrimage?
Well, I think so, because the way that these concepts were actually developed was to look at the various cultures that were being experienced and investigated, and then drawing from them some feeling that of an essence that was in that cultural practice, and exploring that through ritual. So I think that would be ideal at these sacred sites. And one of the things that I felt when I was in Turkey was just a real affinity for the historical basis of this, that this was a place where there was honoring of a different worldview, where the female was, and the whole process of life, and you know, and growing and then passing on and going through rebirth after something passes along, that was all incorporated in those cultures there. And when you see some, even the things at Ephesus that you'll see, the archaeological site that's so impressive, which is much later, it's still showing images that are honoring of, say, Medusa, when Medusa is so demonized in Western culture. Medusa is actually appearing at the top of the library. She's the one that guards the library. And then the library has four female figures there, which represent very important qualities, knowledge and friendship and understanding and wisdom. And that whole facade just gives you this visual impression that these people really honored something very different than patriarchal monotheistic religion. And so as you go to these various sites, you'll see different aspects and see artifacts that you'll hear about that that would give you that feeling of being grounded right in a space where you could then have this ritual that would honor whatever aspect you wanted to do at that particular place.
Well, tell me more about when you were in Turkey. You went there in 96?
Yeah, I went to Turkey in 96 on a tour which was called On the Trail of the Great Goddess. and it was a study tour, and that was just when Catahoulouk was starting to be developed, and that's the site that's near Kona, and it's a very important site that I'd heard a lot about, where a lot of excavations had taken place, and there was a new excavation that was being undertaken at that time. And we were able to go to the site and meet with some of the people who were doing the dig and see some of the things that they were doing at the very beginnings of that whole process. And so that was very exciting to be able to be in that very space where so many of the important discoveries, early discoveries, had been, you know, had been traced to.
Well, and Gimbutas and Miller think that that might have been one of the first egalitarian civilizations, too.
Right, right. And that was what we were hearing about, and then we were hearing about what the next archaeological team was going to do and how they were going to develop that. And they've done a lot of work on that and published their findings and so forth since then. But the idea of being right in that space, for me, for some reason, I just felt a lot of energy that seemed to be very old. And one mm-hmm. of the things that always struck me about my involvement with goddess-honoring perspectives was that when I first got involved in this, it was like an aha experience. I was in my early 20s and really disillusioned with monotheistic religion, didn't see myself represented there, had some, you know, consciousness about feminism, but religion just seemed to be a blank, and that's where it started. It started with monotheism, and you don't hear too much about what happened before that. So this was just a real strong, visceral feeling, even though I'd heard obviously more by that time, just the visceral feeling of seeing these ancient sites and experiencing these places really spoke to me. And for some reason, the land really had a strong feeling to it, too. And when you go to the various museums and see all of the things that were there, and I think in Turkey, at one point, they had an exhibition that I got a catalog for from a friend where they had done 9,000 years of women in Anatolia. So it's got this very rich, ancient feeling of being a strong, female-centered culture at one point.
And for a lot of different cultures with a lot of different goddesses, too. So it's,
right.
Whether you're talking about Mary or Magna Mater or Artemis or Kubaba,
there's all these layers.
Yeah.
And then the whole impression of, say, the Artemis statue that I felt when I was in in that museum where they have the ancient statue, you just feel that there's a presence there, that this was made and this was honored, and this strong female was honored by this whole culture. And you go to some of the place where they were having, you know, their gatherings for Artemis, and you sort of feel like, wow, there is a history to this. And so
you feel connected, that ancient cord. You almost feel connected back to the past, you know, that like a continuous connection, you know.
And I think that's very important because we were taught as women that really history began with monotheism in
mm-hmm.
a way. And because we didn't get very good educations here about other cultures, like Asian cultures, where there's a much more diversified imagery, and there's many images of female divine beings and so forth, you don't hear that so much in the West. It seemed to me that this was a piece of information that was very liberating. And when I read Gimbutas' material and saw that there was another body of material that could be interpreted very differently, and that a lot of this had been sort of hidden from the public view, I was really intrigued.
It changes you forever, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I remember going one time. I had an opportunity to be in Boston, and I went to the Peabody Museum there, and they did in fact have the female images were not displayed, but they did have a bunch of them, which if you asked, they would show you from that were kept in the back. And that was mentioned. I think Shirley Rank mentioned that in one of the first classes that I went to, that many of these things were not shown that
mm-hmm.
were there, or called fertility images when in fact they have a much broader
right.
usage in the culture. So all of this work that's been done over the last 30, 40 years to really educate people and get them involved in this, I think has been really important.
Well, and you know, and what you're speaking of is surprisingly, at least it was surprising to me. You know, you go to the British Museum and things are marked properly, but then you go to the Louvre, which just flabbergasted me, and you're still reading fertility object.
Yeah.
You know, even though it's obviously Astarte with her ruby eyes and you know, her gorgeous, you know, ivory body, they're calling her fertility figure.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it almost feels like it's political.
Yeah.
You know, like who's the curator? Or I mean, I'm not sure. I haven't figured that one out.
I think some of it is political, and I think also if there's a particular museum that you think is doing that kind of misrepresentation, it could be worthwhile to do a little campaign about that. And I know
yeah.
the Louvre seems like the most important museum in the world, but a lot of times people respond to someone coming to them and questioning, you know, how
that's
they're doing
it. That's a good
it.
Idea. That's,
because
that's
I see so many of the museums. I've gone to so many museums over the years, especially when I was doing this work to collect these images. When I was traveling for various reasons, I would try to always check museums and see if they had images I wanted to use in the curriculum. And I would see the change in the way that they were describing things. And over the years, I've seen a much better representation than I ever saw before.
Nice that there's good news.
Yeah, and at one time, for instance, I was very interested in Taoism, and you would always see Taoism represented with male imagery and male concepts, and it was all tied into males. But the museum in San Francisco did a very good exhibit on Taoism about 7 years ago, and it was all about the female imagery, and they did a lot of very good representation, which they wouldn't have done probably 10 years earlier. So I think
right.
we do make a difference when we raise these issues and are able to find people within the staff that will respond.
Yeah, just have to keep pushing that boulder.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And you can't take on everything, but if something catches your attention, it can
yeah.
can feel like a real accomplishment to
right,
to
sure.
get somebody to make a change there, you know.
Absolutely.
And it seems like the French should have a better idea about
well, yeah.
all of this
I mean,
by
here
now.
Here we are,
you know?
In secular Europe, and you know, it made no sense to me. You know, it wasn't like they had the, you know, the Catholic Church or Christianity breathing down their neck.
But you know, what happens is these myths that we were talking about, when we say we want to make them sacred stories and we don't want to say they're untruths, but a lot of things that are out there are just taken for granted when in fact they are untruths. And so in a culture a culture dominated by patriarchy and patriarchal attitudes, you will get certain suppositions that people
That's right.
just think, well, this is the way it is. And then when it gets challenged, there can be some friction going on there. But there's also an opportunity for change in attitude. So.
Well, and I mean, and that reminds me of the struggle of the women scholars with the archaeologist Ian Hodder at Chateau Hayuk.
Right, right.
And, you know, and they've made some progress with him. So, yeah, you have to be tenacious.
Yeah, he was actually the one that I first met when we went there in 1996. He was. We had a little session with him, and we asked him how they were going to handle this, and he gave us a very preliminary attitude that he was going to take in all the facts, and if he found something that was exactly like Mellart, then he could make an interpretation. It was all very difficult to tell how it was going to be handled. But as you said, there was numerous conversations over many years, and from what I've read, he came out with the conclusion that there wasn't a real dominance of women. There was an egalitarian culture
mm-hmm.
going on, but
yeah.
that was the point that was made from the very beginning by the women scholars. It wasn't
right.
that it was a female dominant. So they sort of came out to have a lot of the same attitudes, but it had to go through this whole kind of acquaintance of what each of their biases were. And I think that gets to the fact that matriarchal, for most of the women scholars, does not mean a woman dominating.
Yeah,
it actually means egalitarian relationships.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And most people don't know that, so they don't realize when they're saying that this culture honored women, that was making an egalitarian statement. So
exactly.
I think, you know, that understanding got clearer after Ian Hodder did a lot of his research.
Well, Liz, we probably have about 5 minutes, and I see my other guest, Jeanette, is on the switchboard.
Okay.
How would you like to spend that our last 5 minutes? What do you think would be most important for our listeners, to talk about your time in China, or is there some other idea that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to use these next couple minutes for?
Well, maybe I can make a little bit of comment about my trip to China, because that was for the Fourth World Conference on Women, and it was done by the UN. And what I wanted to say there was that I went to the part of the conference which was the cultural part. There was a whole other governmental part, which I also did study and write about, and had people going to that conference who were reporting back. But the part that was interesting was the cultural part that I was able to attend for about 10 days. And I found so many different expressions there from women around the globe of how they were coming forward. It was very inspiring to see all the actions that women were willing to take, and they did a lot on behalf of the environment. There were actually very women honoring, goddess honoring things going on, as well as all kinds of arts and information exchange. So I was very impressed by how the international women's movement was very cultural as well as political.
Mm-hmm.
And economic, and I think that's something that in many countries women have come forward and been able to take a lot more public role in these cultural activities too. So I think when we do these kinds of multicultural explorations, we're also connecting ourselves with that wider international energy where women are coming forward and they want to lead in a more holistic way in their communities. So I just think anything we can do to reach out to each other, to understand how some of these stories can empower us, and that we don't need to take a negative view toward ourselves as women because of what patriarchy might tell us is the sacred story.
Yep, we have to reprogram ourselves.
I think so. I think there is part of that going on, and I think a lot of that is being successful. So just keep on doing it.
Have you been able to follow, has there been any progress that you might be aware of since your time in China?
Well, I think that being there, there's been a lot of wider understanding of the different situations. I think there's been less progress than people would have liked on some of the agreements that were made in 1995 have not been achieved. Some of the percentages and of women having more participation and more of the benefits of society. But I think that in the ongoing effort to keep that at the forefront of the world governments has been a really good advancement. So, it's a kind of a mixed thing. We have to keep that always in the forefront and keep the stories, as you mentioned on your show, often the stories that are happening in the world, be aware of the negative stories, but also be aware of the positive influence we can have by having this international connections.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Liz, it's been great.
Yes, I really enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, and I'm so looking forward to the curriculum.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing.
Well, and thank you so much for doing it. I mean, I know it was a little labor it must have been.
Well, it was a lot of labor, but it was a very, very enriching experience. And having contact with so many people who were willing to contribute and being able to review so many things and put together different elements of it, it was a pleasure to do while it was also a labor. So that's something I think as women we know what that means. So.
Well, I don't think women hear enough how wonderful their contributions are, and we have to stop that too. I just want to say I'm so grateful for your effort and, just acknowledge it.
I appreciate
it, punctuate that with big red letters.
I appreciate that, and I just want to put in, Mutual Admiration Society, the work that you do and the extent to which you've been involved in all this and making people's voices heard and all of that is a real contribution.
Well, it is my guilty pleasure.
Well, I've enjoyed it and look forward to hearing your next guest as well.
Okay, and one last thing before you go, I want to make sure people can find you.
Oh, yes.
If they would like to find out more about the curriculum, maybe
that's
teach
easy.
It in
that's
their
easy
area.
To do. It's just I have a website, and it's www.riseupandcallhername.com. And on there, there's all kinds of information, and ways to contact me, ways to get the curriculum, and lots of essays and interesting things from the curriculum that you can just peruse if you're not able to do the whole thing. You can get some ideas from there. So, and that's really easy. Again, it's www.riseupandcallhername.com.
Wonderful. Well,
right.
Liz, thank you so very much.
Well,
and
thank you,
I'm Kim. Sure I'll be talking to you once I get going with that curriculum.
Oh, I look forward to it. Okay.
Good night. Have a happy holiday.
Yes, you too.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So if you are just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether we call the Great She a deity, an archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world, just will save the world. And you've been listening to Elizabeth Fisher, author and creatrix extraordinaire. I'm so glad for her work in the world, and I can't wait to teach her course, Rise Up and Call Her Name, beginning at the Goddess Temple in Orange County this March. Well, it's that time when we're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show, and my next guest is Jeanette Clancy, author of God Is Not Three Guys in the Sky, and let me welcome her to the show, and then I'm going to share her bio with you.
Hello.
Hey, Jeanette.
Hi. I enjoyed those last minutes with Liz.
Well, you're going to have to listen to it from the beginning.
I will. But I wanted to say it gave me ideas of things that I would like to mention, and I ran around in my house getting them.
Okay, good. Well, and I hope Liz will tune back in, and she'll hear what an inspiration she was for you, too. Well, you know what? Before we start, let me get my listeners a little bit acquainted with you. And let me apologize because I have a head and chest cold thing going on. Mm. So I'm hoping I'm not going to have to cough or sneeze or anything like that. But I did pretty good with Liz, so I hope it continues. But anyway, this is Jeanette Clancy. She is an educator and writer. She lives in Avon, Minnesota. Oh, God, I bet you're cold up there. She's taught languages and communications to adolescents and adults in a variety of settings. Most recently, she was a teacher of the English language to adult immigrants and as a supervisor of teacher candidates for St. Cloud State University. She was brought up in a blanketing Catholic atmosphere. She obtained a master's degree in systematic theology from St. John's University, Collegeville, Minnesota, but claims an eclectic and generic spirituality. Her graduate degree led to independent study of the historical Jesus, mythology, scripture, spirituality, and comparative religion. She also explores ways to reconcile religious doctrines with science, with the occult and parapsychology, and with atheist spirituality. Besides writing two local history books, she contributed an essay to the anthology The Rule of Mars, Readings on the Origins, History, and Impact of Patriarchy. In addition, she's written for many periodicals, including Letters and the National Catholic Reporter. Frequently, she appears on the opinion page of the St. Cloud Times, and she strives to help build global justice, spiritual understanding, and cooperation between nations and religions. What a wonderful bio, Jeanette. Thank you so much, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a delight.
Well, let me ask you the obvious question first. Your book, God Is Not Three Guys in the Sky, and that part of it makes total sense to me. But then the sort of the subtitle throws me, and you're going to have to explain it to me. The subtitle: Cherishing Christianity Without Its Exclusive Claims. How can you cherish Christianity if God is not, three guys in the sky? I'm a little bit confused.
Well, Christianity, that it really is a good question. Most Christians today don't realize that all Christians throughout these 2,000 years have not believed that Jesus is God. or that his death saved the world. And not all Christians take the doctrines literally. And I don't believe that it's necessary to do that in order to be a Christian. One can be a follower of Jesus, the Nazarene, the spiritual master who lived 2,000 years ago, without worshiping him as God, as different from the rest of the human race, or as completely unique. And what I really object to is the exclusive only Son of God. It irritates me every time I hear it in church. And I do go to church, and the language of the liturgy is so offensive. Last weekend I spent in Fargo, North Dakota, with a Fargo-Moorhead group of women who call themselves Women Church, and our main topic was inclusive language. And we talked about how that the he, him, and his, especially, he, him, and his, as if spiritual reality were exclusively God.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, making Jesus an exclusive Son of God and making God exclusively male and making the Catholic Church, according to the Vatican, the exclusively true religion and church in the whole world. It's all of it.
I love you, Jeanette. You're a wonderful heretic.
Thank you. Some people who don't understand this ask me if I want to start a new church. No,
well, you know, maybe what it really is, Jeanette, is reclaiming something that was closer to what Jesus intended. You know, and it wasn't really what the Vatican represents today. You know, this whole organized religion thing just isn't working for more than half the world.
Yeah, that's what I'd say, too. I think the Nazarene never had in mind that, you know, these exclusive claims. And the Nazarene's teachings are beautiful for anybody in the whole world. It doesn't have anything to do with worshiping himself. Jesus didn't think he was God. You know, he just had a beautiful spiritual instruction. And he had much to teach all of us.
So Jeanette, what do you think are the most common misconceptions about Jesus? Because you've studied him extensively. You know, there's so many stories out there. I mean, you've obviously already said, you know, the difference between was he literally the Son of God or was he just a man? But what about the ideas of did he travel to India? Did he have a real relationship with Mary Magdalene? Was he maybe the first feminist, so to speak?
Oh, stop. There are too many. I'll forget those questions. I don't have a good memory. No, going to India or any place besides Palestine is, no, that's just legend. Mary Magdalene, yeah. Well, Father Richard McBrien, who is a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, said somewhere that that Mary Magdalene obviously was a favored disciple of Jesus. She probably seems like she was the closest one to Jesus. She's mentioned more in the four Gospels than the other disciples are. Mm-hmm. And this business about the 12 apostles, that's legend, too. 12 is a mythologically important number. And, you know, that whole thing was just something that grew up in mythical legendary language. It's not true that this man, Jesus, is the Son of God, and there were 12, exactly 12 guys he chose to... Oh... I have great difficulty. I'm very impatient about beliefs that have no basis in fact. Let's see, what else did you ask?
Well, as you're talking, you know, I'm coming up with more questions. Okay,
oh, good.
So we don't think he traveled to India. I guess, you know, Mary Magdalene was a primary disciple. I guess, and I know a lot of people don't even realize at the time there were lots of messiahs, and I think even other people called Christ. You know, so he wasn't even the one to, I think, have this unique title. Am I remembering that properly also?
Christ means the anointed. And the first Christ in the Bible actually was, now the name escapes me. About 1,000 years before Jesus, lived, was called the anointed. I forget details that I haven't written down right in front of me. But anyway, Christ means the anointed, and it became a title for Jesus. And then eventually, after some years of the Jesus people spreading the word about Jesus, and they were Jews, they were, you know, the first Jesus people were just Jews. They weren't called Christians. But after some years, they started to be called Christians, probably in Damascus. That's what the fact seems to be. And Jesus Christ has become the God image of Christianity. It's the way that Christians image or imagine spiritual reality. They imagine it to be a male father, and then a male son, and then the Holy Ghost. A lot of Christians don't pay as much attention to the Holy Ghost. So it's a way of giving this Nazarene, elevating him, a way of elevating him. But there's another meaning of Christ. The way Christ is spoken of by Paul the Apostle, and the way the term is used by the church for 2,000 years, it refers to the inner divinity. And this doesn't just have to apply to Christians. I believe, I believe that that divinity resides in the center of the universe, that the deepest part of me is what we call God. And the Nazarene, this Jesus, is a symbol of this inner divinity. Carl Jung said this. Carl Gustav Jung, the depth psychologist, you know, the Swiss mm-hmm. depth psychologist, said that Jesus is a symbol of the inner divinity. And the Hindus have theology, although we can't really call it theology, but their theology, if it's to be called that, is similar to that. They call it Atman, and it's the inner self. Let's capitalize S, the word mm-hmm. self. It's the right. inner, deepest divinity within us, and it has unlimited possibilities. And now what I'm bringing in is the theology of Unity School of Christianity, which is a descendant of New Thought. You see, all of these ideas, we can bring them all together, and I think that we are entering a period of post-Christian spirituality. And I can do that while cherishing the tradition from which I come, which is traditional Christianity. I cherish it. I respect it. I think that there are Christians today who are totally unaware of the whole gamut of beliefs in Christianity down through the years, and now we are experiencing some really important transition. We don't know where we're going with this, but I think spirituality is becoming more important, and I think also that the atheists have a role in pushing us toward this new spirituality.
You mean by challenging the beliefs?
By challenging the beliefs and making it clear that literal belief in the doctrines is silly.
Okay.
Put it bluntly, it doesn't make any sense. And what I'm finding, I've had friendships for many years with one atheist in particular, and now with more atheists. And I tried being an atheist myself. I guess I didn't tell you that. I tried being an atheist myself when I figured out that
you couldn't take this all literally.
Yeah, we couldn't take it literally. And so I tried really hard, and I discovered I'm just too spiritual. That didn't work at all. Atheists are atheists because of integrity, because of it's spiritual integrity that drives atheists to become atheists. They are so turned off by the nonsense, in especially Christianity, but in all religions.
Well, but now wouldn't, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I mean, I'll admit I don't know a lot about this, but speaking of atheists, wouldn't they really just sort of have us trade one God for another, and that God would be science? You know, it would be science that would tell us what morality is rather than a God in the sky?
Good question. I think for some of them that is the truth. I divide atheists into two camps. Those who deny spiritual reality and those who accept the existence of spiritual reality.
Okay.
I have a gem of a book that someone led me to called The Little Book of Atheist Spirituality. And the writer, who is a French philosopher, I call him an atheist mystic. Because what he says, when he describes his experiences, he describes what we call God, and he denies that it's God, but it definitely is, the creator, the uncreated creator, or something like that. I mean, that's what... what Christian theologians call God.
Right, right. We're just using different language.
Sure, yeah.
Well, all right, well, let me ask you a few things about all of this. And before we totally get off of Jesus, because I want to go in another direction, because I think I threw too many questions at you at once, what do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions about Jesus that maybe you didn't have a chance to say?
Well, one that I still haven't said is I don't believe he came down to earth to die for human beings. And, you know, I don't believe that his death saved the world.
So you don't believe in the resurrection and all of that?
Well, the resurrection, my parents are alive in me. My older siblings are alive. They've passed away, but they are alive in me. That's a resurrection.
So we're talking semantics again.
Yes, we are. But I will bring up something else. There's also a common misconception that belief in the reincarnation conflicts with Christian theology. It does not conflict with it.
Because that could just be resurrection then, couldn't it?
And that could be resurrection, yes. My brother was a priest. He has passed away. But he and I had a conversation one time, and... either he asked me about the resurrection or it just came up in our conversation. And I said that reincarnation, he must have asked whether I believed in reincarnation and why. And I said the reincarnation could be the resurrection. And he said, what? Three different times I had to say that reincarnation could be the resurrection, that the resurrection is reincarnation. And finally, he figured out what I was saying. It's so contrary, so foreign to the Christian way of thinking, but it certainly could be. That, you know, I believe now that, of course, I always have believed that after death there is life, you know.
Mm-hmm, just our energy shifts from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jeanette, let me ask you then. So does this mean that you think the whole idea of, the Stations of the Cross and him dying on the cross, do you think that was all just part of a myth? That's my first question. So you don't think that any of that really happened?
Well, no, I don't think it. Well, I think I always have believed that the Nazarene really did die on the cross. But whether or not that happened, the important thing is that the myth developed. And now I need to explain the fact that the way it's used in popular culture in the United States means a worthless lie. You know, anybody who believes a myth is just foolish. You're just stupid if you believe in myth. Religious myths are honorable and they have truth. For instance, the Christian myth of God, a parent, sending an offspring to save humanity, that concept has been wonderfully inspiring and encouraging and edifying for human beings for thousands of years. I mean, myths are real in that sense.
So when you think about it like that, it really doesn't matter if he lived or not, because
it's
this myth
matter
that teaches us everything.
Exactly. So, you know, atheists have gotten into arguments with me about whether Jesus actually lived. Well, I think it's silly to deny that he lived. It doesn't matter. The important thing is the meaning behind the stories.
Right. So you're So I get where you're coming from, but I am curious. You know, let me just play the atheist here for a minute. You know, I've been told by people who are not fans of Christianity or Jesus for that matter, that one of the strongest arguments for the fact that Jesus didn't even exist is the fact that Romans were such meticulous record keepers and there was no record of him in Roman accounts. Is that true? Have you heard that before?
Well, I haven't heard of Roman record keeping. Now, there are records, non-Christian records. Seemed to me that one is Plutarch. Again, I wish I had my own writings in front of me. Plutarch, there were references to the Christus who died on the cross, and then the group of people who followed him. I don't think it makes any sense to say that all of these writings, that some of which ended up in the Bible, that all of these writings are about a fictitious idea. And because I have studied the New Testament and have studied the man Jesus, I am so impressed by that man. What he taught was really unique, and the kind of person he was is unique. It makes all kinds of sense to me that the man actually lived and taught a spiritual master who inspired people around him, and that as a result of the extraordinary person he was elevated to a god after his life. That makes a lot of sense because he was extraordinary.
Well, when you say elevated to a god, are we talking literally or figuratively there?
Well, people, you know,
people
elevated him. You know.
So, do you think he really did the miracles, or that's just part of the myth?
Oh, the miracles. I have a whole section in my book, God Is Not Three Guys in the Sky, on miracles, and I love talking about that. And I ask the question, did the miracles happen? Well, I think that quantum physics is giving evidence of the fact that the miracles did happen. Because quantum physics says that consciousness has a role in what happens in the physical world. Human consciousness makes a difference.
So give us an example. Take one of the miracles and tell us how it's quantum physics at work.
Well, what I'm saying is that when people believe their you know that the Nazarene often said, your faith has saved you, when he healed. And it was their belief, their trust in spiritual power, their trust in God.
So it was almost their power of positive thinking.
Yes, that's really what it was.
Well, and there too, you know, like you started saying at the beginning, you know, the divine within, you know, and he said
mm-hmm.
many times, you know, seek within yourself or whatever that,
mm-hmm.
I can't think exactly what that.
And it won't come to me right now either, but that's correct, right.
Okay.
So this is really a key feature of new thought, that our thoughts create our reality, that we have to change our own interior beliefs and trust and believe that we have great possibility, believe that we deserve good things, believe that we can do what comes right for us, that this, our reality will follow our beliefs.
Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I've said to, you know, I'll actually teach in class sometimes and tell people that they create their own reality and they kind of look at me crazy, you know. But I always use the example of a rich person, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
If you grow up rich, well, you don't expect to be anything other than that.
That's
and
right.
So you sort of get what you think is going to happen to you. But if you're poor, I think it's harder to believe you're going to be rich. It's easier to believe your circumstances are going to stay the same, and often they do.
Mm-hmm. Our consciousness creates our reality. And another word for God, I think a very good synonym for God, is consciousness. Consciousness.
Hmm.
Consciousness with a capital C, when we're talking about the very source of it all. But consciousness is in all of us. And remember I said that the deepest part of me, of any one of us, is God. The divinity resides at the center of the universe. Another way of thinking of it is that God or divinity is the within of everything.
Well, Jeanette, you know, I'm connecting the dots here, and if this is all true, then we better get our shit together as people, because nobody's coming to save us but ourselves.
Well, that's exactly right. That's what I believe. Yeah. We all have to get our shit together and take control of our lives in that way. But it requires, before, when you were speaking with Liz, you said something about, oh, yeah, reprogramming ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the problem, is we have been held back so long. We've been conditioned not to believe in ourselves. And, you know, I sound so good, don't I? I can recite all of this, but I struggle with it myself.
I have
great difficulty. I'll tell you, leading up to this last weekend, getting ready for a weekend and spending 2 days speaking to women in Fargo, North Dakota, which is 3 hours away from my home. In preparation for that weekend, and now in preparation for other events, I said to myself, it's okay if everything goes all right this weekend. Do you follow? You see what beliefs
and so,
in myself I have.
So in other words, you were worried that it wasn't going to go well?
No, that in a sense. But no, the deeper thing is that I have this habitual attitude of something has to go wrong, or don't count on things just going right. I mean,
you're a big believer in Murphy's Law.
I'm supposed to suffer. See, that's what a good Catholic learns.
Oh,
we're
yeah, okay.
To suffer. That's what life is all about. You suffer enough, and then you have merited a place in heaven.
Well, Jeanette, if we start thinking the way we're talking about tonight, well, first of all, we could do away with all the priests, because we don't need an intermediary. We could even do away with the Pope. What would be left besides the myth of Jesus? Would we need any of it besides the myth of Jesus?
Well, we don't need the myth of Jesus either. You know, a lot of religions have their own God images. But I also want to say that religions are brands of spirituality, and they have done a lot of good. You know, religions aren't all bad. They're not all nonsense. For instance, during the civil rights struggles of the 50s and 60s, religion played a huge positive role. So religions, you know, and the religious people that I know are wonderful people. I am very fortunate. I live next to a monastery, a male monastery and a female monastery, and I go to church with the women religious, and they're wonderful people, and they understand things, and, you know, many of them understand things as I do. Let's see, what else did you ask?
Well, I guess where I was kind of going with this is, well, it sort of led me to the next idea. You know, all the hypocrisy out there of the so-called mm-hmm. Christians that is really just greed, or you know, they feel entitled to exploit others because, you know, they're not, don't have the same God and all of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think actually that they, what's happening in the United States, the most regressive, the most, I'm hesitating because I don't want to offend a lot of people, but I really think the most controversial, the most conservative aspect of Christianity is just a reaction to what's really going on underneath the surface, which is this new thought and new ways of understanding spirituality. It's a reaction, and it's going backward. It's regressive. And I think that is evidence of the fact that we are entering the post-Christian era.
So what do you mean by that? You think Christianity is going to become obsolete?
I think that Christianity is, we can already see that it is losing its dominant place in society. It's no longer the case that Christianity has the only answers that anybody accepts. Think back, oh, I don't know if you're old enough. If we think back 30, 40, 50 years ago, the large questions of life were answered in the Christian way.
Okay.
And today there are a lot of other ways of looking at, of answering these questions. And there are more questions being asked.
So even though it feels like the Christians have a stranglehold here in the United States, maybe even sometimes a boot on your neck, you think it sounds like you think it power is slipping away.
Oh, I really think so. Oh, it's quite obvious, don't you think?
Well, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. You know, when I see how influential they are in politics, it really scares me, you know.
Oh,
it really does.
Yeah. I know. It is very scary. But already the Christian right has lost some political clout. It really has. Think back to the 1990s. I don't think the Christian right has as much power today as it did back then. The ones who are fighting vociferously, there are more fierce fighters, but I don't think that they're really gaining more power. They're waning in power. The hysteria, the political hysteria, is accompanied by religious hysteria, but it's not religion driving it mainly anymore. I think it's more political partisanship that's the larger driver of hysteria today.
Well, Jeanette, let me ask you this, because it's not often I get to speak to someone like you with such a progressive perspective.
And religious at the same time.
And at the same time, yeah. Uh-huh. What I'm wondering is why, I mean, the church, it would seem to me, this is just my opinion, and tell me where the flaw in this thought is. If the church came out and would be more vocal about, for instance, I don't know. I guess I'm saying let the church be political, but I know they'll never come out for abortion. Okay, so I'll put that aside, you know, even though it really bugs me that, you know, women are secondary and all of that. But why can't they...
I hope that you go to my latest blog post. I said I'm a pro-choice Catholic. Be sure to
read it. All right. Well, you can maybe mention that, but and we can talk about it. But before I lose my thought here, why aren't the churches saying, yes, we need health care for people? We can't keep letting corporations outsource jobs.
Good,
you know, this,
good question.
You know, why is – I mean, the church could become relevant again. So what's wrong with them?
especially the Catholic Church. Other churches have said these things, and Catholics say these things, but the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, beginning with Rome, and the bishops and archbishops who were appointed by John Paul II, after Vatican II, John Paul II had this long, long tenure as the Pope. I forget how many years, but it's one of the longest papacies in history. And he undermined Vatican II to the extent that he could. He appointed conservative bishops. And the hierarchy of the Catholic Church today is more conservative than it's ever been before in Catholic history, in the United States at least. And what I'm hearing, I told you about the wonderful monasteries, male and female monasteries that I live next to, that if we say that church, and Vatican II said the church is the people, if we talk about the real of the people in the Catholic Church, many of them and many of religious believe that we should be talking about those moral issues, that we should talk about peace and health care and so on. And I read those articles in Catholic publications. I read them. But the media, if you would listen only to the media, you'd get the impression, well, you evidently do have that impression, that the whole church is just preoccupied with abortion and gay marriage and regressive and rigid.
Absolutely. That's exactly the impression I have.
It's not fair to the people of the church.
Well, I mean, okay, and maybe this is just a crazy idea, but if these conservatives are not the majority, if we see, you know, our country and our people dying, you know, why can't some, I mean, with the money and organization of the church, why can't they just, these people just be ignored?
Sort of
something else grow up on the side of it, you know, sort of make them irrelevant.
We have those conversations. I tell you. Well, for instance, I have to think. I don't think I'm hurting anybody else if I say that. No, other people, I'm not hurting anybody else. But I'll tell you that I belong to a group of women who are promoting women's ordination in the Catholic Church. Did you know that there are Roman Catholic women priests?
Oh, yeah, I'm having one on the show in January. I've known about this for a while, yeah.
Who did you have?
Well, I forget her name. She's out of San Diego. She's somebody that was just ordained, but I've known about women priests for a while.
Right. So we have seven, I believe, in Minnesota, and we have regular liturgies where they preside, and they give the homily and so on, and we promote this idea. We get together and we talk about having to have a different theology from the official theology. In the official theology of the church, priests are a separate clerical caste and they are privileged, and, you know, that's what led to the clerical abuses, the scandal of clerical abuse. And there are Catholics who are speaking out. National Catholic Reporter, for instance, if you would read the National Catholic Reporter consistently, you'd get an entirely different idea of Catholicism.
Okay. I will. Yeah. I will.
Because
you know what? I don't want to feel like this, quite frankly. I don't want to be mad at the Christians all the time. you know,
there are really good people.
You know, that's the people I come from, and I know a lot of them are good people, but I guess I feel like, you know, why aren't they doing more when they have such an organized machine that they could tap into, you know?
Well, see, the machine part of it, the institutional hierarchy doesn't allow it. The institutional hierarchy is like in lockstep agreement with what comes down from on high, from the Vatican. And the Vatican is scared to death that women might get some power. It's scared of losing power and authority.
Yeah.
And they can't admit that they've made a mistake. You know, it was really humorous. The Pope made this statement lately about condoms, you know?
What a joke.
And then backtrack immediately and say, we're not really changing what we said before. We never change our mind. We've always known the truth. That's the reason, by the way, that the Vatican back in the 1960s came out and declared again that contraception was wrong. The Pope simply could not bring himself, the Pope at the time, what was his name? Paul. Names run away from me when I need them. Anyway, the Pope at the time could not admit that the institutional church had made a mistake in declaring artificial contraception evil. And so, you know, everybody around him, moral theologians, said, this needs to be changed. The teaching of the church needs to be changed. He could not bring himself to admit a mistake. And as a result, Catholics just routinely sin, you know, if you call it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I'm thinking of, too, you know, when that story came out about the condoms, you know, the way it came across to a lot of people who were talking about it on Facebook was, oh, he's concerned about the male prostitutes using condoms, but not wives who may get AIDS from their husbands, you know, or not women who want to have some control over their family planning. I mean, it just seemed like something out of the Dark Ages, but I'm sure this is nothing new to you.
Well, I think actually he didn't have male. I've been told that, or I've read that male prostitutes were not a bigger thing in his mind. I don't know. I didn't hear the original, and I'm hearing contradictory statements too, but I would tend to believe that he simply, what the official, let me see if I can say what the official interpretation is now, that condom use still is wrong. Yeah, they went back to that. But it's a person who uses a condom in order to prevent more evil, for instance, HIV.
The spread of AIDS, yeah.
Yeah, that's it's good. It's moving in the right direction.
So they'll kind of look the other way if you're trying to prevent another evil. Okay, I get it.
Oh, no, it's still wrong. You know, you're still using it. Silly.
It's all about abstinence. It's all about abstinence.
It's a sick attitude about sex.
Well, let's talk about the wonderful nuns. I remember when Stupak in the Congress was trying to derail health care.
Yes.
The nuns came out and spoke up. I was so proud of them.
Oh, I'm so proud of them. The nuns are the coolest people on earth. I just sent a thank you note to the sisters at in Fargo to tell them that. And I've said that in my blog. Well, actually, I quoted somebody who wrote that in National Catholic Reporter. He was talking about a nun, maybe in Asia or in Africa, who was feisty and tooling around the country on a motorcycle to minister to her people, you know, that kind of thing. Nuns are wonderful people, and they have an awareness that far outstrips most Catholics and most Christians. They are progressive, and they're doing good work. Without nuns, the Catholic Church wouldn't. It's nuns who are holding up the institution. It's nuns who are doing all the work. Nuns who have been teaching and ministering to the sick and having spirituality centers and, I can't think of all the things that they've
done. So, Jeanette, then maybe it's the nuns. You know, maybe we just kick all the guys to the curb and leave it to the nuns. You know, let the nuns be the new leaders of the church.
See, the thing is, the organization, the institutional structure is there, and getting past that institutional structure.
Yeah.
I don't know. Someday it's just all going to go
maybe.
Up.
Maybe. Well, you know what? Let's,
an important part of what's happening is the Roman Catholic women priests, the women's ordination. That's one. There are good things happening. We'll see where it goes.
Okay. Well, we probably have about 10 minutes left. I'm wondering, did you want to talk a little bit about the way you sort of reconcile the religious doctrine with the occult and parapsychology? Was there more to be said about that?
Oh, parapsychology. Well, when you go to my blog, by the way, let's give my blog, my website is easy to remember, godisnotthreeguys.com. And the three is not spelled out. godisnotthreeguys.com. And then you can go to my blog. And in my blog, I have a blog index. And one of the categories in my index is paranormal. I call it paranormal. And I have many stories told to me by people of things that science cannot explain. You know, Carl Jung, for instance, talked about clocks stopping at the moment of death. When my brother, the priest, was dying, he was dying in Detroit, Michigan, and my cousin, who was very close to him, had a candle lit here in Minnesota. She didn't know exactly what day he was going to die, but she had a candle lit. And to the best I can figure it out, the candle burned out the moment he died. Things like that happen. Clocks, did I say this already?
Yeah.
Stop at the moment of death. Animals sense that something is going to happen. Dreams predict what's going to happen. One of my recent blog posts was written by a friend who told the story of a certain figure of money that came to her in a dream, and sure enough, they got exactly that much money, and I think it was a tax refund, and it saved them. You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Science can't explain it. These are. And that's parapsychology. It's
right.
It's psychic power, and it is spiritual power. The psyche, you know, is the Greek word for soul, for spirit.
So your thinking is that when the person passes over, it's their energy that's causing these things to happen. When their energy body leaves their physical body.
Mm-hmm. The most important, our identity is our soul. We don't have a soul. Soul is who we are, and this spirit entity, this essential part of us, continues living. It's finished living in this three-dimensional time-space. And then it continues living in another dimension, the spiritual dimension.
So are you thinking, do you have a theory on the idea of ghosts? I mean, do you think they're really ghosts?
I think there are. Yeah, I do think that there are spiritual entities in some cases. And you know, I've asked myself this question for years and years and years, and I think now now my belief is that, yes, there are spiritual entities who have not reconciled themselves to their death, to what happened in this life, and they may haunt a place where they lived. And in some cases, I think that there are spiritual entities who appear to help us. To help
you mean like angels? Angels,
uh-huh.
More or less?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I do believe in angels in that way. Spiritual entities who are here to help us.
Okay.
And I've just come across so many stories. They can't all be made up.
Right. Well, what is your idea of what happens at death then?
The physical part of us dies.
Right.
And the entity and the spiritual entity lives forever.
But are you thinking? What is your idea of, you know, when the physical body dies, what happens
to
the soul or the energy?
To
be reincarnated, or I mean, I guess what I'm asking you: do you believe that there's a heaven? Do you think there's literally a heaven?
Heaven and hell are. I mean, there is an afterlife. Put it that way, and I don't believe any soul is condemned to eternal hell. I mean, that's
mm-hmm.
silly. I think that we continue. Well, I believe that we continue learning and growing spiritually after death, and that part of that growing, learning and growing spiritually is maybe having another incarnation, another life on this earth or in another dimension. You know, there's no
mm-hmm.
reason to think that there aren't other dimensions, other places, places that don't have the three dimensions of space and time, you know, just entirely different. Some things that are beyond our
comprehension.
We can't figure them out. We don't know. But I believe that there's just a lot more that, well, you know, there's this quotation that I have in my blog, and I can't think of that. It goes something like this. It's from Hamlet. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than your philosophy dreams of.
Well, Jeanette, we're almost out of time here, and it's been wonderful talking to you. You're so interesting. You've restored my faith in Christians again.
Wonderful.
And you know what? And I know I shouldn't feel that way. It's just I see too much negativity in the media, and you know, and I think I'm going to have to start reading the Catholic Reporter again.
There are so many thoughtful Christians, mature, thoughtful, educated Christians.
Oh, I know. You know, I've gone to talk at Christian feminist groups, and so I know there are. I mean, I've had Father Roy Bourgeois on the show, the one who defied the Vatican, you know.
Yes,
so, yeah, I mean, I am friendly with good Christian people. I get angry that the good ones aren't more vocal, though.
I do, too. It's so frustrating.
Because, I mean, look, imagine, I mean, I know we don't have much time left, but imagine, because so many people will be motivated by religious leaders. If enough religious leaders spoke out, it could stem the tide of all of this ugly divisiveness that's tearing the country apart. You know,
but
it really could.
In Catholicism, at least, the religious leaders are institutional leaders. And in Catholicism, they were appointed by John Paul II, who did all he could to reverse the advances of Vatican II.
So what you're saying is there are no quote leaders that could take that torch and run with it. They're probably just at the local priest level kind of a thing.
Yeah. And people like Roy Bourgeois, you know,
right.
the Vatican stepped on him. The Vatican excommunicated him. people who do step out are excommunicated. There's a John Haight, a theologian, who wrote a book called Jesus, Symbol of God, or something like that. It's basically my Christology. He's banned from preaching. Hans Kuhring was banned from preaching in a Catholic university. Charles Curran, I mentioned him in my blog post on abortion, banned from teaching in a Catholic university. The Vatican just nixes the progressive anything.
Right.
Progressive
right.
thought, progressive people, progressive teaching. It's
I'm convinced we progressives need to get more assertive.
I think that too. We've got to speak out. And, you know, part of me gets scared sometimes myself because I don't, well, it wouldn't matter to me if I were excommunicated, but what would matter to me is if my religious friends turned against me, you know, if they didn't like me, that would hurt terribly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's getting to the point where not many people really care what the institution says or does anymore.
I think
or,
right.
you know, you know, I mean, people
or
are getting.
Or at least the thoughtful people.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Jeanette, in 2 minutes, is there anything you'd like to say that you feel you want to share with listeners we haven't talked about?
Oh, I'm sure I'll think of all of it when we're finished. I don't know. Why am I still Christian? I'm still Christian. I'm just Christian because that's who I am. I tried leaving, and I can't not be a Catholic Christian. It's just my identity. It's stapled in my bones. And so I will continue being a Christian while I talk about post-Christian spirituality. if that sounds contradictory, so be it.
Nope, I can wrap my head around that totally. just like I can wrap my head around the idea that there's a goddess and there's evolution.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, the goddess is simply a feminine image of what we call God, of the source.
Right.
Source is another really good synonym for what we call God.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't have a gender, which makes it you know, to some
right.
people even better, you know.
It's
so.
Beyond gender. It created gender.
Yeah, because, I mean, and shouldn't it be beyond gender? I mean, after all, I mean,
of
if
course.
It's, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Jeanette, it's been lovely. Let me mention your website and blog again. The website is godisnot3guys.com. And the blog is the same thing.
godisnot3guys.com-
Jeanette.blog.
Well, you'll just find it, yeah. I
you'll
think
find it.
Let's just give this simple one, and then they'll see blog.
Okay, one leads to the other. So
godisnot3guys.com.
You have just been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I know it was a little difficult for you to call in tonight, and I appreciate you making
fine.
The extra effort.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. And, you know, I really appreciate what you've said. You know, it's been a wonderful night. You have restored my confidence in Christianity.
Wonderful. I'm very happy to do that.
All right. Good night,
okay.
Jeanette, and have a wonderful
Good
holiday.
Night. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed Jeanette as much as I did, and we're really running short on time here. We only have 2 minutes, so I am going to close the show, shift gears a little bit, and I'm going to read you our closing prayer, which I think is rather beautiful. It goes like this. Let a renaissance of earth, goddess religion, lead us to a new age of enlightenment. May love and wisdom guide us in building a multicultural world cultural civilization based on respect and cooperation instead of greed. Let the rebirth of Mother Goddess and our world family culture be the new world order. Well, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in,
And I hope you'll be back with me next Wednesday. And may you and your family have a wonderful holiday. And please go check out my Examiner column, check out my website. And I love to hear from you. I love the feedback. So please, don't hesitate. Send me an email. And remember the three F's. Marcus is your favorite, your friend, and follow us. And good night.